Keep in mind when you read these laws that they are approximately 3,500 years old. Sometimes people read these laws and say, well, it seems to me to be a bit chauvinistic or a bit harsh or a bit cruel. Well, in reality, the cultures of that day were extremely chauvinistic and brutally cruel. And this would be radical and shocking that God would be putting parameters and regulations upon the cultural mores and norms and practices of the people of that day. When we look back at laws in our own country that were written 100 years ago that are still on the books, they're laughable. For example, did you know to this day in Washington, D.C., taxi cabs are required to carry scoop shovels and buckets. Now, none of them do, but the law is still on the books that if a public transportation person doesn't have a scoop shovel and a bucket in their vehicle, that they can be fined $50. So if you ever go to Washington, D.C. and take a taxi cab, just say, hey, I'm going to make a citizen's arrest unless you can prove to me that you have a scoop shovel and a bucket in your taxi cab. Well, the law obviously is outdated from a different time, no longer applicable, but it's still on the books. In Vermont, it is illegal to whistle underwater. That law is still on the books in Vermont to this day. So if you go to Vermont, you can inform the Vermontians that if any of them are whistling underwater, they are breaking their own law, which is still on the books. Now, in North Carolina, it is illegal to tell a joke from the pulpit. And you're saying that is a crime, especially some of yours, John, but be that as it may. All of these laws that you can look into and explore, and there's hundreds of them, they're humorous, they're antiquated, they're totally bizarre, but yet when we read these laws, they still have relevancy and application, you see. And oftentimes I feel that we look at them as being harsh only because we haven't really thought it through. That is the tendencies of people. For example, we left off with this classic passage, verse 24, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, and stripe for stripe. And people say, hey, that's not grace, that's not mercy, that's brutality. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, stripe for stripe, wound for wound. You have to realize that in this there is a great deal of mercy and grace. How so? Well, when Peter John was in first grade, he came home one day from school and he had his clothes kind of dustied up and slightly torn here in the shoulder area. And he had the tracks of tears that were still staining his cheek. And you know, I said, Peter, what's going on? And he said, well, this guy in school in my class, the biggest guy in my class, his name was Everett. I don't know, there's something about that name, I'm not sure, but his name was Everett. And Everett beat me up. And I said, Peter, really? Well, what happened? And Peter related a bit of the story and we talked about it. Well, the next morning, it was Tuesday morning, he comes out of his bedroom, he's set to go to school, and he's carrying something behind his back. And I say, Peter, what do you have behind your back? He said, well, today, Daddy, today in school, it's show and tell. Well, what do you have to show and tell? And he held out a baseball bat. And I knew who he was going to show, and I knew what he was going to do with that bat. And so I made him put it back in his room and take a baseball card to show and tell that day. That's the tendency of people. You see, if you push me down, man, I'm going to knock your block off. If you poke out my eye, I'm going for both of yours. If you knock one tooth out, man, I'm going to give you a knuckle sandwich where all your teeth are going to be popped out, you see. That is human nature. That is the human heart. That is the tendency of our flesh to say, hey, if you hit me once, I'm going to pop you twice. Well, the Lord here, you see, is saying, no, that's not going to go. If one eye is taken, then only one eye is going to be charged to the person who violated you in that way. It is requiring really restraint and justice. Now, later on, Jesus would take it even further, and he would talk about the Mosaic law, this section specifically. And he would talk about, listen, I'm telling you yet even a higher way. If somebody hits you in the cheek, you are to turn the other cheek. I know, he said, you've heard it said of old, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. But Jesus said, now I'm telling you how it's supposed to be. Well, that raises the question. People say, well, then, did God change his mind? Here in Exodus, he talks about eye for eye. And John, maybe I can see what you're saying. Knowing the heart that's in people, even in me, we might say, yeah, if somebody blackens my eye, I'm going to go for both of his. So I can see that. But then why did Jesus say, turn the other cheek? Now listen carefully. Because there's a thing in the Bible called progressive revelation. That is, as God takes his people, his family, over the years on a journey toward maturity, he gives them more and more information about the way that life ought to be lived. Now you do the same thing with your family. When you're talking with your 3-year-old, your 5-year-old, you have a whole different set of standards than when you're talking to your 15-year-old or 18-year-old. You expect more from an 18-year-old than you do from a 3-year-old. As the kids get older, you expect more and more from them. The demands are greater. The expectations are higher. Don't you understand that that's exactly what God is doing with his family? So it's not as though Jesus comes on the scene and God has changed his mind about this eye for an eye thing. It's that now this was important for this season. They were coming out of enslavement in Egypt, surrounded by paganism. And God was starting from that place with his family, the children of Israel. And as they mature, as the centuries go on, then it becomes increasingly clear what God's heart really is. Here he gives allowances for marriages that have multiple wives. That's not his heart. Jesus said, that was not the heart of the Father. Jesus said from the beginning in the Garden of Eden, it was seen what God desired. But these things were done at this point because the people were already involved in having multiple wives, and they were not handling it in a way that was wise or fair or just. And so God puts down regulations. He is not instituting these things. He is regulating those things. This is a really important point that as you travel through the Word, you're going to discover the unfolding revelation of the Father. It climaxes, it cultivates, it crescendos in the person of Jesus Christ. Now we have the real deal, you see. Now we have the full heart and the full mind of God revealed in his Son, God in the flesh. But there's a progressive revelation, and it's just like you do with your kids. If your 1.5-year-old messes up his pants, he doesn't make it to the potty, you know, you're not upset with that, or you shouldn't be. But if your 19-year-old doesn't make it to the potty, and you know, you have a problem with that. You know, you got to sit down with your son, and you got to say, son, we need to talk about some stuff here. Why? Because 18 years have passed, and you expect a lot more from a 19-year-old than you do when your son is 1 or 2. The same thing is true with our Father. There's a progressive revelation. Well, be that as it may, from the very get-go, this was radical. This was shocking. Unlike any other culture, really. And that is eye for eye, not two eyes for an eye. Tooth for tooth, not two teeth for a tooth. He is putting parameters. Mercy, really, and grace. Although it will be more fully explained when Jesus comes on the scene, then we get the full heart of God on this issue, you see. Well, if a man, verse 26, smite the eye of his servant, or the eye of his maid, that it perish, he shall let him go free for his eye's sake. If he smite out his manservant's tooth, or his maidservant's tooth, he shall let him go free for his tooth's sake. So you have a servant, and you smite him in such a way that a tooth pops out, or an eye is lost, then he or she is to go free. Kind of, if you are from the Vietnam era days, kind of 4F. Maybe you remember those days. I do. I was at Biola College during the Vietnam War, and people were really trying to get 4Fs, that is, those deferments, the physical deferments, so they wouldn't be called up and taken off to go to war. And some guys, a couple guys in our school, truly, this really happened, to get 4Fs to be disqualified. You see, if you had fallen arches, they wouldn't take you in the draft. You would be excused on the basis of fallen arches. There's a couple of guys in our dorm that went on top of a three-story building, and every night they would jump off the roof of this building in order to get fallen arches, you know, so that they would not have to be drafted. They got their 4F that way. Now, me and my roommate, we found a better way, not the fallen arches, but the golden arches. You just go to McDonald's, and you just, every day we went to McDonald's. Every day at Biola, it was right down the corner from where our school was, oh, about a half mile away or so. And every day, man, I tell you, that's where all that was my downfall. That's where it began. There on La Mirada Avenue, the Golden Arches at McDonald's. Every day I had a Big Mac, a fish filet, a large fry, a cheeseburger, a milkshake, and a hot fudge sundae. That was my daily lunch. Well, I don't know why I thought of that, but be that as it may, the point of this is if somebody is hurt, they are to be set free. It's a 4F, a physical deferment, if you would. They're to be free from further service if indeed they've lost an eye or a tooth. If you've done that to them, then they go free. Now, verse 28. If an ox gore or an owl gore, if either one... Sorry about that. Man, if an ox gore a man or a woman that they die, then the ox shall be surely stoned, and his flesh, that is the oxen's flesh, shall not be eaten. But the owner of the ox shall be quit or cleared. But if the ox were wont to push with his horn in time past, and it hath been testified to his owner, and he hath not kept him in. But he, that is the ox, hath killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and his owner also shall be put to death. In other words, you're responsible for your animals. If you have an ox who gores a person, and the person dies, and it was a first offense, it was an accident, well then, you don't pay the price for that. But the ox has got to be put to death. And by the way, a little footnote here, God declares, the owner of the ox shall be cleared, but his flesh, that is the oxen's flesh, shall not be eaten. In other words, the ox dies and you can't barbecue him. The ox is put to death and you can't have a great big barbecue saying, hey, oh well, let's have a party. The ox is killed and is removed and done away with. Now, some people have a hard time with this in this day of animal rights activism. They say, well, that's not fair, you see. In fact, right now as we speak, there's a case in Wyoming that perhaps you've heard of, perhaps been following. There is a Wyoming guide, a hunting guide named Bill Hill, true story, And Bill Hill is right now in trial, and he is in jail presently because Bill Hill, this guide, shot a grizzly bear. And he gave a defense a couple of weeks ago that was interesting. You know, he said when he was being tried, the trial's still going on, he said, here's the thing, he said, when I saw that grizzly bear charging down the mountain toward me, I immediately knew who the endangered species was. And he's saying, what could I do? I mean, this grizzler's coming toward me, you see. But it's a big trial and it's big controversy. You know, we live in a time when we put a real high priority on animals. But God says that's not the issue. People are more important. And if an ox gores a person, the oxen's to be put to death lest he do it again. Now, God declares this. If the ox had a tendency in the past, verse 29, if you knew that he was an oxen with those kinds of propensities or tendencies and you didn't keep him corralled properly, you knew he was a dangerous oxen, that he was a bad ox, but you thought, hey man, it's my ox and I'll take care of him, that's fine, but if he gets out, then your life is to also be taken. God is saying, I'm holding you responsible if you know that this animal, that your property has those propensities. God says, I'm holding you responsible. Interesting that there is to be a responsibility for people that have pets or animals or whatever it might be. In New York City right now, there are over 1 million stray dogs. Stray dogs just walking around the city. If you lined them up single file, it would be a parade that would be over 25 miles long. Stray dogs. And they say that 1,500 puppies from these stray dogs are born every hour. I think half of them are in my neighborhood somehow. I don't know. We have lots of dogs running around these days, including mine. But be that as it may, you know, God is declaring here, there is to be a responsibility for your property. If your property is potentially dangerous or damaging, you need to be responsible. And that's a lesson that needs to be, I think, heard in this day in which we live, when people don't want to take responsibility for anything. Well, God declares, you're responsible. Or, verse 30, the word if there is or, and it has it in your newer translations and many of them. If there be laid on him a sum of money, then he shall give for the ransom of his life whatever is laid upon him. In other words, the owner of the ox that had this tendency to be a bad ox, and this bad ox gores a person, the owner has to die or settle monetarily. That's all verse 30 is saying. You can pay for it with a sum of money. If I own the ox that has had this tendency to do bad stuff, and now he kills somebody, either I die or I arrange a monetary settlement. So if I can work out a deal with the family of the person who lost their life because of my ox getting out one time too many, okay, that's allowable. So there can be this monetary settlement. Now, verse 31, still talking about these oxen, our personal property. Whether he have gored a son or gored a daughter, according to this judgment shall it be done unto him. But if, verse 32, the ox shall push a manservant or a maidservant, he shall give unto their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. What this is saying is simply this. Here's the deal. If your ox gores a man or a woman, a boy or a girl, the same rules are required. That is, the owner of the ox dies or works out a legal settlement that's agreeable to the offended family, to the survivors, you see. So God declares there's no difference between a son or a daughter, a man or a woman in verse 31. But verse 32, if it's a servant who dies, it's not a man or a woman. It's not a son or a daughter. It's a servant, a manservant or a maidservant who is gored, who is killed by this bad ox. Then the price is to be 30 pieces of silver. Now one would say, that's not fair. We would say, wait a minute, that's biased and bigoted and prejudicial or whatever the word might be. It's not the way it's supposed to be. The servant who dies, hey, why is there only a 30 shekels of silver price attached? Well, we know why. What was Jesus Christ, the servant of all? What was the price that was paid for him when his life was given? 30 pieces of silver. A picture is being painted. There's clues being given. That Jesus Christ, who on the cross, Psalm 22, speaking of it prophetically, would cry, I am a worm and not a man. Oh, this Son of God, this one who is God, became like us, became lower than us in a sense. For he became the lamb, not just a man, but he became the lamb. Not just a lamb, but he became a worm. That is, he was slaughtered. He was gored, literally with a spear, pushed into his side. And he was sold for 30 pieces of silver. And now we can begin to understand that these things are not just regulations, but illustrations. That Jesus Christ would be despised and rejected. That he would be the servant of all. That he would be mocked and treated brutally. And yet he did so willingly for you. He did so willingly for me. So we see here now, in the case of a servant, 30 shekels of silver if one is gored. Now, verse 33, a new topic. If a man shall open up a pit or a well, or a man shall dig a pit and not cover it, and an ox or an ass fall therein, the owner of the pit shall make it good and give money unto the owner of them, and the dead beast shall be his. So you're digging a pit. You're digging a well, let's say. And you don't cover it properly. You know, you're out there working, digging, and you take a lunch break. Or you go get a donut and some coffee. And while you're away, you know, there at the snack wagon, you know, somebody's ox or somebody's ass walks by and falls into the hole and dies. Well, here's the deal. If you didn't cover the pit properly and mark it out properly, then you are to make it good. You are to give the money to the person who lost their ox, who lost their donkey. You are to pay the full price. It's your responsibility. Well, they should have watched where they were going, one may say. What a dumb donkey or a dumb ox. That's not the way that God views it. I am, you are, we as people are to take responsibility. And again, if it's left open, then what happens is you have to pay full price for the lost donkey, the lost oxen, whatever it might be. And yet, you get to keep the oxen, though. The beast shall be his. The dead beast shall be the one who dug the pit. Now, that's good and bad. It's good because you get some barbecue oxen or whatever. But it's bad because you got to get it out of the hole. And that's not an easy task. I mean, you got to pay for the thing and you got to somehow get that baby. That's like that zoo worker, you know. He's walking by carrying a shovel and tears are running down his cheeks. And one of the persons there that's at the zoo sees this zoo worker go by and asks one of the zoo guides, who's that? Oh, he's a worker here at the zoo. Well, why is he crying? Oh, he has to go bury a dead animal. Oh, how sweet. He must really love animals. It's not that. It was a hippopotamus. A lot of digging to do. A lot of work to be done, you see. And that's the same idea here. Okay, if an animal falls in, you get the animal. That's the good news. Bad news is you got to get him out of there. See? So God declares that's the way it works. Responsibility has to be upon the shoulders of the person who dug the pit and didn't provide safety. Well, it says in verse 35, if one man's ox hurt another that he die, then they shall sell the live ox and divide the money of it. And the dead ox also they shall divide. But, verse 36, if it be known that the ox hath used to push in time past, again, a bad ox, and his owner has not kept him in, then he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead shall be his own. So he has to, in verse 36, he has to give the live ox, he has to give the living ox. If it's a bad ox, if my ox beat up your ox, but my ox has been a bad ox in the past, and your ox dies, I've got to give you my ox. I get the dead one, but you get the live one. You get mine. Now, if my ox does not have a reputation as being a bad ox, just two oxen are just fighting, then verse 35 kicks in. The two oxen, they fight each other. And what do? You take the live ox and you sell it and divide the money. And you take the dead ox and you divide that too for barbecue, you see. It's fair and square. Two ox fight. Neither ox has a bad reputation. Neither's on the FBI 10 most wanted oxen list. They're just normal ox, and they get in this confrontation. Oh man, one of the ox dies. Well, then I'm to take the live ox, whosoever it might be, sell it for money, divide it in half, and we each get half. And then the dead ox, we split that in two as well, and we each get to have some barbecue. That's the way it works out. Now, it's interesting because, again, I wish I could go into, I won't tonight, can't do it right now. But these things are wonderful in light of what other cultures were doing. The Jewish people understood that the Father was exceedingly fair and righteous. In fact, when you talk about this dividing of the dead ox and the dividing of the live one too to make things fair and equitable, it just makes sense. The rabbis have taken this particular thought and applied it to, in even this day, in Orthodox groups, about what to do when a parent dies who has not left a will. Well, if you've been around, you know how tough those things can be to negotiate, to navigate. Now, the Jewish rabbis, from this kind of a verse, from this precept, and from this kind of basis of fairness and equity, have devised a way to deal with those situations. That is, if the parent dies, the parents are now gone, and there's an estate to be settled, the oldest son is to divide it into equal parts. Let's say there's three children. The oldest son is to divide it into thirds, and the youngest son gets first pick, and the oldest son gets last pick. Now, what does that do if you're the oldest son and you know that it's your job to divide it into three equal parts and you're getting the last pick? What will you do? You'll make sure that it's totally, completely fair because you know that you're getting the last pick, you see. Well, it's those kinds of rightnesses and equities and morality that's coming into play here that will affect the Jewish community and all those that take the time to think through what God is declaring in the Mosaic Law. Tremendous application. And again, if we had time, and we don't tonight, we can see how many of our renderings and many of our legal matters, particularly in times past, have their roots and their foundations in the Mosaic Law. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Well, let's take a look and see some more before we go our way. If a man steal, verse 22, an oxen, or a sheep, and kill it, and sell it, he shall restore five ox for an ox, and four sheep for a sheep. If I steal your ox or your lamb, and I kill it and eat it, or if I kill it and sell it, I am to restore, if I did that. That oxen, I'm to restore it fivefold, or if it's a sheep, fourfold. Now here's the thing. Listen carefully. Now as God is getting into these legal judicial matters for the culture, for Israel, He's laying out a very workable, important principle. And that is restitution. Now listen carefully here. Restitution. You are to pay back big time if you committed a crime. The Jewish people, this might come as a surprise to many of you, but the people of Israel in this theocracy, in the Old Testament economy, knew nothing of incarceration. There was no such thing as jails. None. Interesting. When we, in our culture, you've been reading the stories in the past couple of days in USA Today or on the news, it's all over the place. We are now the most jailed people in the world. We passed up Russia this past year. We have 1.8 million people in jail in our nation. 1.8 million. That means for every 1,000 people, a group this size right here tonight, 66 people are in prison, in jail. It's an amazing thing to think about. For every 1,000 people, it would be like in this group here, 66 people, numerically, statistically, would be in prison in our country today, and we're building more and more jails. You know what's happening. But here, God, in His economy, with His people, it was not about incarceration. It was all about restitution. It was all about paying back what was ripped off in a huge way, or losing your life in many of these situations. There was restitution and there was deterrence. I mean, you know, when you read through the Mosaic Law, you realize, wow, there's some serious ramifications if I don't take responsibility. I could die. Or if I commit crimes, I could die. Or in stealing, I've got to pay back five times. Now, here's the interesting thing. If a guy is stealing, then how is he going to be able to pay back five oxen if he stole one? Because in many of these situations, the guy that stole would be obviously poor or in need. And here's the answer. The family was required. In other words, the whole family was held. If you don't think that caused mom and dads and grandma and grandpas and aunts and uncles, there was tremendous pressure that would be in a family to not mess up. Because you see, if Benny did something wrong, if he stole a lamb, well, obviously Benny, who's 11, can't pay back four lambs. So it would fall upon me. So I will be diligent to train my son. I've got responsibility. And this is how the economy worked, that is the legal situation and climate worked in Israel. Restitution, deterrence, family pressure. And this is how God ordained it to be for His people, you see. Now, if a thief, verse 2, be found breaking up or breaking in and be smitten that he die, there shall no blood be shed for him. If a guy is breaking into a house and he's killed because you hear something going on and you grab your gun and you shoot the intruder, the prowler, the burglar, and the burglar dies, that's the way it goes. He came onto your property. He came as a burglar, as a thief, and you will not be responsible. If in the night, in the dark, you're not sure what's going on, you shoot him, you smite him, you kill him, God says that's just the way it goes. You see. There is a case right now in Seattle, Washington. Absolutely amazing to me. There is a thief, a burglar, who was climbing on the roof of a home trying to figure out a way to break in. He didn't see that he was walking right into a skylight. The skylight gave way. He falls down and he breaks his back. Well, the police are called and the guy is apprehended and he is found guilty of breaking an entry. He sues the company that made the skylights for making an inadequate skylight because it broke. He won $1.5 million in a court settlement from the skylight company because it broke when he was breaking into the house, you see. Crazy. Now God says that doesn't go in essence here. He says, look, if you're a burglar, then you're fair game. That's just, you're taking your chances. Yet, verse 3 puts a qualifier on that. Verse 3 says this, Yet, if the sun be risen upon him, there shall be blood shed for him. He, the thief, should make full restitution. If he have nothing, then he shall be sold into slavery, if you would, for his thievery. Interesting. Now, what's being said here is this. Now, look, somebody breaks in your house. It's dark. You don't know who it is. You don't know what's going on. You take your gun or your baseball bat or whatever it might be. Hey, that's the way it goes. Whatever takes place. But, listen, if there is light, if it's daytime and not in the middle of the night, if there is light, if the sun be risen on him, there shall be blood shed for him. In other words, if the sun is out, if the room is full of light and you see the guy and you kill him, then you're responsible. That's not allowable. And what God is declaring here, it's most interesting. With increased light comes increased responsibility. If you have light, then you have to live up to that light. You can't say, well, you know, there was an 8-year-old that broke into my house, so bam, 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 I let him have it. No, if you could see, let's say in this analogy, that he was 8 years of age, you have no business, you know, pulling out your shotgun and saying, well, the law says, God says no. If it's dark and you're not sure what's going on and you're afraid and you're not sure what's taking place, that's one thing. But if the light is shining, with increased light comes increased responsibility, you see. There's all kinds of implications in that and all kinds of dimensions. But God is saying, if there's light, then I'm going to hold you responsible if you kill the intruder and the light was shining. That ought not to happen. But rather, the thief, verse 3 says, should make full restitution. Whatever he had taken, whatever he was stealing should be given back. And if he's already, you know, put it out to some, fence or what have you, then he is to be sold into slavery to pay off the debt. Now, if the theft, verse 4, be certainly found in his hand alive, whether it be ox, ass, or sheep, he shall restore double. So if the thief now, he's caught red-handed with the animal, with whatever he had taken, if he's caught red-handed, then he is to pay back double. I want you to note this, or at least be aware of this. There is an exception found in Numbers chapter 5, verses 6 and 7. The exception is this. If a guy steals and his conscience bothers him and he confesses, he's not caught red-handed, he's not apprehended by the authorities, he just realizes that he blew it, he feels bad about it. The book of Numbers then modifies this law, as we shall see, and says he's not to pay back double, which is 100%, but he's to pay back only 20% above and beyond that which he took. So he's to pay back, if he stole $100 and he feels bad about it, and he confesses to the authorities, if you would, he's to pay back $120. And that's all that is required if he comes in honesty. But if he's caught, then he's to pay back $200. He's to pay double, you see. So God here differentiates between those that are caught in their crime versus those that just desire to come clean and say, you know, I blew it. It's like the true story of the guy that wrote the IRS and said to the IRS, enclosed is $400 that I have ripped off the Internal Revenue Service over the past 20 years. I can't sleep at night. My conscience is bothering me, so please accept the $400. He said, if I still can't sleep, I'll send the rest. And here God is saying, pay back twice unless it's your own decision. You weren't caught. You weren't busted. Then it's only an extra 20% above and beyond what you had taken. If, verse 5, a man shall cause a field or a vineyard to be eaten, and shall put in his beast, and shall feed in another man's field, of the best of his own field, and the best of his vineyard, shall he make restitution. If I allow my animal to graze in your field or your vineyard, man, if that's happening, I am to pay you back with the best from my field. Not saying, oh, I got some old leftover grains or some rotten grapes here, take those. But God declares, no, if your animal was in their field, or if your family was in their field or whatever, you are to pay it back with the best from your own, you see. And same area, if a fire, verse 6, breaks out, and catch in thorns so that the stacks of corn or the standing corn or the field be consumed with the fire, he that kindles the fire shall surely make restitution. So if I'm in somebody else's field where I ought not to be, and I'm in somebody else's area and I have not had permission, you see, and a fire breaks out, I'm to pay for the damage that is done. Now, interesting, because the book of James says that the tongue is like a what? Fire. And a lot of good fruit, speaking of fruits and corns and vineyards and all the rest, a lot of good fruit is burned by activities of the tongue. And I was talking to a person a couple of days ago now, who was sharing with me that they had damaged somebody by talking about her in a way that wasn't right. And this person was saying, what should I do? Well, the principle from this verse is simply that you make restitution. What do you mean? You make it right. You make it right. Because fruit has been destroyed. Good fruit has been damaged because of the fire, when you were poking around where you ought not to be poking around in somebody else's business. You had no business in their field. It wasn't right. So now you have to make restitution. Well, how do I do that? By replacing the fruit that was lost. Well, how do I do that? By talking to the people that you talk to and saying to them, what I said was unfair and untrue, and I was very, very wrong. To do whatever you can do to replace that which was lost because of the fire that was set when you were in a field that you ought not to be in. Wouldn't it be great if whenever a person did that, gossiped or shared something that ought not to be shared, poking around in some field that they have no business in, that they would understand God's heart in these matters and say, I need not just to ask the person I talked about to forgive me, but I need to talk to every person that I talk to and say, what I said is not right, unfair, not so, and I sinned. It's a good thing. I like this principle. It's an important one, I think. Now, it gets real tricky here. If a man shall, verse 7, deliver unto his neighbor money or stuff to keep. Hey, take my stuff or my money and keep it for me. I'm going on vacation. And I want you to watch my stuff, or I want you to hold my money while I'm gone. If it be stolen out of the man's house that was watching the stuff, if the thief be found, well then let the thief pay double. So while you're watching the stuff or you're holding that guy's money, a thief breaks in. Well, and the thief being caught has to pay back double, you see. But here's where it gets tricky. If the thief be not found, then the master of the house shall be brought to the judges to see whether he have put his hand into his neighbor's goods. The guy says, would you watch my $100? I'm going to be gone for a day. Oh, sure. Guy comes back. Where's my $100? Well, a thief came and stole it. Sorry, it's gone. Well, how do I know that? I mean, how do I know you just didn't put your hand in my stuff, that you didn't take my bucks? You're to take that person to the judges for all manner of trespass. Verse 9, whether it be ox or ass, sheep, raiment, or any manner of lost thing, which another challengeth to be his, the cause of both parties shall come before the judges. And whom the judges shall condemn, he shall pay double unto his neighbor. You take your case to the judges. Now, Paul picks up this same principle in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, folks. If there is something that is wrong between you and a neighbor, you and a brother, a sister, a person who's part of the believing community, the church, the judges you are to go to is the church. You are not to go to court, Paul says. He says, don't you know that you guys, he says, you Christians are going to judge angels? 1 Corinthians 6. By the way, that doesn't mean the angels are going to stand before us and we're going to say, where were you on October 13th when I stubbed my toe? That'll be 500 shekels, you know. To judge the angels means that we, in the kingdom that's coming, are going to be overseeing the angelic work. That's what we're going to be doing, amongst other things. We're going to be judging, not judging in a courtroom sense, but we are going to be authorities over the angelic host. Now, Paul says, because you're going to judge angels, can't you figure out situations amongst yourselves that need to be arbitrated? Don't go to the courts. The courts, how many of you guys know that the courts don't really care always about the truth? Do you know that? Are we unclear about that? It's all about, in our day, who's got the cleverest lawyer and the trickiest strategy, who's got the money. Did you read the news this morning? I did. O.J. Simpson is now cutting a commercial. True story. It's a commercial for a law firm. And it just, I go, I can't believe this. And he's appealing to people that feel as though they're in trouble and they need good legal counsel. And so he's telling them such and such and such and such a firm is there to help you, and, you know, they're tremendous helps to me and all this stuff. And you go, my goodness, this is amazing, you see. We all know, I think most of us understand that our legal system in these days has been corrupted. It's not a matter necessarily of trying to get to the truth. It's a matter of winning the case, regardless of what the truth might be. Well, God's not there. That's the way our system works, and you can argue the merits or the problems, that's fine. But the fact of the matter is, God is into truth, desiring truth. And so, Paul says, you go to the church, because the world doesn't care about the truth necessarily. The world wants to win the case and be clever and tricky. The church ought to decide these matters. I camp there for this moment to say this. We do that here. We arbitrate matters here. I arbitrated one a couple of days ago. It's an important thing that we allow the church, the brothers and the sisters that have wisdom and understanding in biblical matters, to sort through situations. And that's what they were told to do. If there's a problem, you go to the judges. And again, those judges were not, as we think today, black-robed judges. They were spiritual leaders in the community. If a man deliver unto his neighbor an ass, verse 10, or an ox, or a sheep, or a beast, or a Ford Mustang, or a Dodge Viper, or a Plymouth Colt, to keep it, and it be driven away. See, that's the application right there. It be driven away. So you commit to your neighbor, you know, your Ford Bronco or your Mustang or whatever it might be, and it's driven away. You say, hey, I told him to watch my car, or watch my ox or my donkey, whatever it might be. And man, it's no longer around. It's dead or it's hurt or it's driven away, and no man sees what happened. Then watch this. This is interesting. Verse 11. You leave your animal or your car with your neighbor, with your friend, and it's hurt. The car dies, or the car's driven away, or whatever it might be. Well, then, verse 11, shall an oath of the Lord be between them both, that he did not put his hand unto his neighbor's goods, and the owner of it, this is hard, the owner of it shall accept the oath, and he, that is the other party, shall not make it good. I didn't steal your car. I was watching your car and the car was taken away, or I was watching your ox or your sheep or your ass or whatever it might be. And no one has any evidence. They both are to take an oath, and the oath is to be accepted. If the guy says, I promise, I vow, I take this solemn oath, I did not rip off your donkey or your ox or your Shelby Cobra, whatever it might be. Then the person who lost the ox or the sheep is to say, I accept that. Interesting. He's to accept it. If somebody gives you their word and makes an oath, God declares in this economy that is to be accepted at face value. Well, what if they're lying? God will deal with that. Well, what if they're trying to pull a fast one? God sees. The book of Hebrews says, all things are naked and open before him with whom we must deal. God sees. And that's the way that life was to be lived. If a guy gives his word, takes an oath, then you're to accept it. If he's lying, God will deal with him. Now, God is declaring here to us, I do believe, that it is not in our power to really know what's going on inside the heart of another man. We might think he's lying. We might suspect that he's not telling the truth. But God declares, that's not your business to sort that out. It's not your business to figure it out. If there's no evidence, nobody has seen a thing. You see, that's the context here of the verse. No man seeing it, verse 10 ends, then you're to accept his word at face value. Now, if, verse 12, it be stolen from him, he shall make restitution unto the owner thereof. Now, here's the thing. If the animal is dead, hurt, driven away, wanders away, hey, I didn't do anything, I promise you, then you're free. But if the good is stolen, verse 12, this is a little different category, he shall make restitution unto the owner thereof. Why? Because there's a factor of carelessness involved. If the idea is, if the guy says, listen, it was stolen, it was my responsibility, I know to watch it, and I neglected through carelessness, then he is to be held responsible. If it be torn in pieces, then let him bring it for witness, and he shall not make good that which was torn. If the animal is ripped apart, torn up, then bring the torn up animal, and that will be proof. Don't just say, well, your animal, sorry, friend, your animal was ripped apart. Bring it as evidence. Let people see. Like that story of the lumberjack who was selling a chainsaw to a preacher. And man, the lumberjack said, this is a powerful saw. I guarantee that you'll average 50 trees a day with this thing. I mean, this is one powerful chainsaw. Really, the preacher said, guarantee? Yep, guarantee. Okay, well, okay. And the preacher took the saw, made the deal, bought it. Several days later, he came back to the lumberjack and said, man, you didn't do me right. This saw, you know, I've been using it for 4 days and I'm only averaging 4 trees a day. And you said it would take out 50 trees a day. And here's the saw. This is a piece of junk. I've only taken out 4 trees a day with it. Let me see that saw, the lumberjack said. And he grabbed that saw and he grabbed the cord, pulled that cord. And the preacher said, what's that? What's that? What's that? See, the preacher didn't know that it was a power saw. He was using it like a regular. Anyway, you bring... I like those preacher jokes. But you bring the evidence. If something's broken, doesn't work right, you bring it and you say, hey, here's the deal, man. It was torn apart. It was ripped up. It wasn't me. It was an animal or what have you. And you prove it that way. If that happens, you bring it and then you're set free. Verse 14, if a man borrow anything of his neighbor and it be hurt or die, the owner thereof being not with it, he shall surely make it good. So if you borrow something from your neighbor, verse 14 says, you are responsible to maintain it. That's all it's being said. If you borrow anything from your neighbor and it be hurt or die, and the owner's not there, you who borrowed it, if it's ruined, hurt, damaged, you are to make it good. But, verse 15, if the owner thereof be with it, if the owner's right there, and the tool or the animal, whatever it is, you know, is hurt or falls apart or whatever it might be, the owner is there, then you don't have to make it good because the owner is right there watching you, or he's right there by the animal, or he's right there with the tool. You don't have to make it good. Now, if it be a hired thing, it came for his hire. So if you hired it, if you went down to West Main Rentals and the thing breaks, again, you're not responsible to replace it if it just broke and you rented it and it broke. And that's the idea here, you see. So if the owner is there or if you rented it out, then you're not held responsible. But if the owner wasn't there and you didn't rent it, you just borrowed it and it fell apart or died or whatever it might be, you are to make it good. Verse 16. If a man entice a maid that is not betrothed or seduce a virgin and lie with her sexually, he shall surely endow her to be his wife. Interesting scripture. If a man seduces a woman, he is essentially saying, I do, right then. In this God's economy, as it relates to these people, the principles are applicable, I think, in many, many ways. Once a man lies with a maid, he is marrying her, whether or not they had a ceremony or a proposal or whatever it might be. He is making his choice right then. This is the way God had his nation work. Once you are involved sexually, you are married to that person. Now, this would have a real impact on the way young people behave. It would have a radical impact on the way guys function. If a guy was told and a guy was taught and a guy knew that this was required by God in that day, if you bed her, you are marrying her. That's it. Period. That's it. She's your wife. You seduce her, you're saying not I did, you're saying I do. You're saying that's it. She is your wife from that time on. Most interesting. Now, what though happens if the dad says, I don't want that guy. I don't care what he did. He's not going to be my son-in-law. He's not going to take my daughter. Well, there's a provision for that. But if the father utterly refused to give her unto him, if the guy's, you know, a jerk or an idiot or whatever it might be, and how many of you dads know that you can feel that way? Yeah, it can happen. You can feel that way when it comes to your little sweetie pies and all the rest. So if the father utterly refused to give her unto him, listen, he, that is the guy that seduced the girl, He shall pay money according to the dowry of virgins. He still has to pay a dowry. The father can say, no, you're not going to take my girl. But the guy still has to pay a dowry. So if the dad says, I don't want you to be my girl's, my daughter's husband, the guy that seduced her still has to pay a full dowry. And in those days, that was a huge and significant sum of money proportionately. So, the choice was then, the guy would either have to marry the girl and pay dowry. If the father said, no, I don't want you in my family, jerk, then the guy would still have to pay. The guy would still have to pay the dowry. So either way, the dowry is paid. And the father decides whether or not to accept this man into the family or not. I think it's good stuff. Good stuff. Here's one to think about at Halloween time. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. You just don't allow a witch to live. Those that are involved in occultic activities, tendencies, they are to be dealt with severely. And certainly we as Christian parents ought not to flirt with this or joke about that in seeing our kids dressed up like witches or goblins or what have you during the Halloween season or during any occasion. It ought not to be joked about. It ought not to be made light of. God is deadly serious about this issue. That in the occult, in witchcraft, there is demonic power. There is a darkness that is dooming and damning, and it must be taken with deadly seriousness. Whoever lies with a beast shall surely be put to death. And so an absolute command that bestiality is not to be embraced at all. Heard a story, the Moscow Circus that was traveling around Russia a few years back had a woman who was a lion tamer, and she was very beautiful. And, you know, there in center stage there in the circus, there was the cage, and a lion comes in, and the crowd's all watching. You know, the ringmaster is outside the cage, and the woman lion trainer goes in there. And she cracks her whip, and the lion just totally, you know, just kind of cowers down and gently walks over to her and takes his paws. And he puts his big paws, you know, on her waist. And he just sort of nuzzles her underneath her cheek like this, affectionately. Well, one of the guys in the front row said to his friend rather loudly, "What's so great about that?" The ringmaster, who was close by, heard that. And the ringmaster said, "Well, sir, I'd like to see you try it." And the guy said, "No problem, love to. Just get the lion out of there first." Get it? Put his hands on her waist and nuzzle. Yeah, well, anyway, this is something which is... When I heard that, I roared. I just thought that was so... Rod, you don't get it, do you? You get it? Yeah? So anyway, you're not to be involved, obviously, with animals in a way that's inappropriate. And sad to say that in our culture today, we have to address that. It's just the place that we are, and say it's absolutely unacceptable. Now, he that sacrifices unto any god except the Lord, that person shall be utterly destroyed. Thou shalt neither vex a stranger nor oppress him. Don't come down on a stranger, one who's not of your culture. You were strangers, God says, verse 21, in the land of Egypt. Be careful that you don't vex, look down on, oppress, be intolerant of the strangers. God says, you were strangers. You were strangers in Egypt. So how dare you, God would say. How could you be intolerant of others, we might say immigrants today, or people of other backgrounds, or whatever it might be. Make your own application. But the principle is very, very real. You were a stranger, and some were stranger than others. And you shall not afflict any widow. Don't hassle the widows. Don't afflict the fatherless child. If you afflict them in any wise, and they cry at all unto me, I will surely hear their cry. My wrath shall wax hot, and I will kill you with the sword. And your wives then, they'll be widows. And your children, they'll be fatherless. You exploit or take advantage of widows or fatherless children, financially, let's say, or exploit them in some way. Hey, there's no man in the house. I can sell her this policy or make her, buy into this thing, whatever it might be. Be careful, God says, because I will hear their cry. It seems as though our Father in heaven has a special place in his heart for fatherless children and for women that don't have that immediate covering. Don't rip them off. Don't say, hey, I can charge her, man. She's a single gal. She's a widow. She's a divorcee. I can really charge her a bunch for this tune-up because, hey, she'll never know the difference. God says, I'm watching. And you rip off the widow or you rip off the fatherless child, and they cry unto me at all, I will hear their cry. And God says, and your children will be fatherless, and your wife will be a widow. I will deal with you. If you lend money to any, verse 25, of my people that is poor, thou shalt not be to him as a usurer. Thou shalt not lay upon him usury. You don't charge interest to people in the family. Now, if you loan him money, and you're not to charge interest, but if you do that, and if you at all take, verse 26, your neighbor's raiment to pledge as collateral, you shall deliver this coat back to him when the sun goes down. So you're saying, okay, I'll loan you the $5, give me your coat as collateral until you pay it back. Well, God says, okay, but know this. When the sun goes down, when it gets cold, you better give him his coat back, no matter what. For that, verse 27, is his covering. It is his raiment for his skin. How shall he sleep? It shall come to pass when he cries to me that I will hear. Now, would you mark this last phrase here, verse 27? For I am what? Here's what I want to call your attention to very briefly, but significantly tonight. God is gracious. But he's not just gracious toward you. He's gracious toward the people that you're working with. He's gracious toward the people that you're involved in these transactions or negotiations. God is saying, I'm gracious, but John, it's not just grace towards you. I'm gracious towards them, towards him, towards her. I care deeply about those people. Well, yeah, but they're in trouble and they shouldn't have made those bad deals and that's why they have to ask me for money or whatever it might be. I can get very hard-hearted and very arrogant and very, well, if they would have just got a job or got an education or if they would just, apply themselves a little better. God says, I'm gracious, John. Not just to you, I'm gracious toward them. Be very careful that you don't become cold, ripping off their coats, holding it for collateral. Be careful that you don't say, well, freeze, man. That's your problem. Why are you out there, with your sign up there by Wendy's? Why don't you get a job? That can easily creep into our hearts, can't it? God says, I'm gracious. Be careful. Be careful about your attitude, John. Be careful. I'm gracious. I really care about those people. I'm in love with those folks. Errors have been made, yes. Mistakes and problems indeed. But John, errors have been made by you too. And mistakes and problems are in you as well. I'm gracious towards you. Be gracious towards others. very important. He's talking about attitudes of the heart. Don't let them be left out in the cold. Don't keep their cloak. If you can keep them warm, do so. Now, verse 28, thou shalt not revile the gods, or as your margin says, or newer translations, the judges, that is your leaders, politically. You're not to curse the ruler of your people. Interesting. Yes. Thou shalt not delay, verse 29, to offer the first of thy ripe fruits, or of thy liquors, or wines, juices. And the firstborn of thy sons shalt thou give to me. So you are not to delay your tithe. There are people that delay their tithe. They say, well, and I talk to people sometimes that say, well, I have an account and I'm letting my tithe build up. And then in due season, I'll distribute it or disperse it as I see fit. That's not what the Bible teaches, in my opinion. I'm not to delay to bring my tithe. That is, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 16, taking this premise, let each of you on the first day of the week bring that which God has blessed you with. It's not to be held in a separate account and left up to me when it's going to be released or how it's going to be used. God here says you're not to delay the fruits, the liquors, the firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. By the way, Bible students, keep in mind that at this time, the firstborn son in every family would be serving as a priest. But that would soon change, and we'll talk about why later on, not tonight, don't worry. So it was no longer the firstborn son that would serve in the temple or the tabernacle. It was the tribe of Levi and the sons of Aaron. But initially, God desired that every family, that the firstborn son of every family would be set aside for ministry, set aside for priestly service, that every family would be participating in this fantastic calling of serving as priests, you see. That was God's intent. But that would be changed for reasons we'll explain a little bit later on. Likewise, verse 30, shalt thou do with thine oxen, with thy sheep. In other words, you give the first of your oxen, the first of your sheep, the first of your children, the first of your fruits. Now, 7 days it shall be with his dam. That is, the young sheep. 7 days with his mom. The tendency is to say, oh, well, the little lamby isn't ready yet. That's the idea. You know, little lamby, so sweet and so woolly. We don't have to give him to God yet, do we? Can't we just let him just kind of hang out with the fam? The kids love little lammy. God says, no. 7 days, and that lamb, that first lamb, is to be given to me. 7 days, pardon me, with his mom. On the 8th day, pardon me, it shall be given to me. And finally, you shall be holy men unto me. You're to be holy. Yes. Neither shall you eat any flesh that is torn of beasts in the field. You shall cast that to the dogs. A mark of holiness is your diet. What do you mean? You're not to eat food, meat, that has been torn by beasts. Watch what you eat. Now, I'm not talking about physical food here, but I'll tell you this. A lot of times we take in a bunch of stuff that's been torn up and shredded by Arnold Schwarzenegger and those kung fu guys and all the rest. We take in an awful lot of bloody, junky stuff. We eat on it. We feed on it. And God says, don't do that. Your holiness is going to be affected by your diet. You're to be holy men. Take care about what you put into your system. We know that in New Testament terminology, in New Testament economy, this is speaking of what we feed on in our hearts. We're not to eat that which is being ripped apart and beasty and all the rest. Be careful, be wise, be holy. Let's pray, shall we? Tonight, Father, as we have looked at these scriptures together, please help me, help us to not be cold-hearted. Help us not to feel as though we can't accept another person's word. Help us to be those, Father, who realize that you are gracious, not just towards us, but towards every person. That you are a Father of compassion. I pray, Father, that we might walk in the light, that we might understand the principles that are here, that with increased light comes increased responsibility. And with increased responsibility comes increased opportunity. And with increased opportunity comes increased satisfaction, fulfillment, and rewards eternally. May the Applegate family, Father, may we be graced by you to walk in wisdom. May we do well. May we choose to be holy men and holy women, not Pharisees, not legalists, but hearing your heart and living life in a way that's pleasing in your sight. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.